Well, that was marvelous, unfortunately. Thank you, Stanley. The title of my paper, and there may be some spaces for people to sit up front and down the aisle here. There's no point in standing through this horror. So if you want to come up and... The title of this paper is The Habitations of the Word. Plato's Phaedrus has seemed to some critics to have too many subjects, to be drawn first in this direction and then in that, as if those uncooperative horses which it has created, flown, and thereby caused to be celebrated, were pulling apart its pages. Is it about love or about oratory, the scholars ask? Is it a vision or a recitation, an allegory or an exercise? It is at least all of these, but I should like to believe that this extraordinary dialogue is fundamentally concerned with the local habitation of the name and with the nature of honest eloquence, the speech which is just, the speech which can be believed, and that it goes about its business by providing us with a classification by means of model and example of the various residences of the word, at all times seeking the best address. When we ask ourselves what a word is, we may be wondering whether it is a complex set of sounds or a more or less regular march of marks which have come to have a special significance because of all the context they've been used in, each one shaving its sense more closely to the skin. Or we may be inquiring about the word's relations or roots, or puzzling ourselves about the unenviable middle place it takes between thing and thought, object and idea. But I wish to ask the word a few questions about its native state instead. I want to know where it is from. The Phaedrus opens with a curious exchange between Socrates and Phaedrus concerning a new composition by the noted rhetorician Lysias, which Phaedrus has heard only that morning. Obviously intended as a display piece to demonstrate the orator's art by taking a difficult, if not perverse, point of view, Lysias' speech argues that an impersonal lust presents in principle a better suit for the favor of a beautiful boy's body than love can, that selfish pleasure is a safer motive and provides a more secure environment for its object than passion does. And Socrates shows an immediate and ironic interest in this subject, wishing only that Lysias had proved a similar superiority for poverty and age, not excluding Socrates' other debilities. And the initial implication of Socrates' little joke is certainly a serious one. Namely, that Lysias's composition has a use, that it might be employed by anyone who had the orator's leave or had paid his fee, and had a nice young man in mind. For it was out of just such an expectation of payment that Lysias had written his brief for the defense in the case where two men had loved the same boy and come to blows over him, and again for a similar quarrel over the purchase of a slave girl, and yet another time for the prosecution of a guardian guilty of embezzlement, or when money had tempted his pen to the defense of a farmer accused of cutting down a sacred olive grove. In one case only, as far as we know, did Lysias himself speak what he had written. On that occasion, he prosecuted Erosthenes for the execution without trial of Lysias's own brother, Polemarchus. And when Socrates asks Phaedrus to repeat the oration for him, Phaedrus protests, calling himself an amateur, presumably with respect to the feat of memory it would require to fulfill Socrates' request, and complaining that he should not be expected to reproduce in a moment what it had taken such a wonderful writer weeks in the inspired labor of his leisure to create. Socrates then pretends to believe his friend can do just that. He suggests that Phaedrus has already badgered Lysias into repeating his speech. More than this, that he has begged the loan of the manuscript in order to study it closely, commit it to memory even, and that Phaedrus has made his way just now beyond the city's walls in order to rehearse what he has memorized, to release into the indifferently receptive country air the winged words which he has so earnestly and carefully caged. As it turns out, Phaedrus has borrowed the manuscript and has it held in his left hand, hidden under his cloak. He has it held in his left hand because this speech, these words, belong to the black horse of desire, the left-handed horse whom the charioteer must check if the soul is to rise. Now, Socrates insists on hearing the entire work, re-spoken, not silently re-read, rather than the summary Phaedrus was hoping to give him, and by that gift demonstrating, if not his command of the art of verbal memory, at least his ability to recall in the right order the principal points of an oration, an art which, much later, Cicero and Quintilian would call a memory for race, things, objects, subjects, important points in a discourse, instead of the more strenuous and particular one for verba, words got by heart. It was the memory for things which was so important to the sophists, jurors, politicians, and those parts of the public who felt it necessary to be able to return to mind, whenever they wished, the shape and substance of what had been said on some previous occasion. Whereas it was the memory of the word precisely as it stood among others, which principally concerned the poets and the rhapsodes and certain of the rhetoricians. In order to perform Lysias's allegedly eloquent composition, Socrates and Phaedrus seek out some shady spot and settle on one near the banks of the Ilissus. Their conversation is rich in allusion and reference. No god's name is taken in vain. No uttered word lies idle. Yet Plato's artistry, never greater than in this dialogue, and equaled only by the philosophical poetry of the Phaedo and the Symposium, provokes the paradox of his prose. For this dialogue is to be a defense of the word which simply flies sincerely forth from an open and unencumbered heart, whereas the language which so eloquently states that case possesses qualities which are possible only to words which are not merely written but composed. My shopping lists, my address book, my checks, my sick child's school excuses are written. My lies, my love letters, my legal briefs, my limericks, my longueurs are composed. Now, we have scarcely begun the dialogue. We have yet to hear Lysias's speech, to read the hearing of it, that is. And already various forms of the word have begun to proliferate. We encountered, first of all, and quite naturally enough, the written words of Plato, which comprise and create the occasion and conditions of the dialogue. Then we meet the spoken ones, which Plato says were uttered by Socrates and Phaedrus. Next, there are those composed by Lysias, borrowed by Phaedrus, and read aloud, possibly performed by him, rather than memorized and taken to heart. Lysias's speech, although given life and spoken by Phaedrus, although approved by his breath, has not been made his. It has not been given residence in his head, which is doubtless a wise thing. For what is it to take a guest of this kind into the interior of the soul, from whence words rise like a sudden spring? What is it to offer your hospitality to the opinions and passions, the rhythms and rhetoric of another, perhaps far from perfect, character and mind? Socrates declares that he can make up a better speech than Lysias's, accepting even the rules of the game and the assumptions of the debate, namely, that it is better for a youth to yield his body to one who desires but does not love him, than to one who does both, especially when the love in question is a blind and selfish passion. But Socrates is reluctant to make good on his boast. And one reason surely is, although several are evident, that the words will not be his. He must pretend to be a vessel which is filled by another, possibly by the muses whom he invokes, though this is even doubtful. For would the muses be inclined to sing on such a subject insincerely and to a false point. Not only that, but Socrates will have to match his wholly improvised and unwritten speech against Lysias's cleverly contrived and carefully composed one. Socrates's oration is masterfully made up on the spot by a character whose very figure, as well as every known word, has been artfully imagined by Plato over years of passionate dedication. It is a so-called unwritten work which has been written and rewritten. We can be sure more than once. Its alleged lack of composition has been composed and recomposed. Its off-the-cuff character has been indelibly inked on the page. Socrates further guards himself against the anger of the gods, for his words will blaspheme the real Eros, who is said here to be one of them, by inventing a lover who, while pretending to be free of love's passion, the better to satisfy it, will simply pronounce the words which Socrates makes up for him. Neither Socrates, nor the mask which Socrates holds out in front of him, believe the words they are mouthing. Whose words, then, are they? Literally, they belong to no one. The first two speeches of the Phaedrus are exemplary orations, models, specimens, or types, without any actual occasion to bring them into being, representing no actual mind. They belong to the art of eloquence, to rhetoric in the abstract. They are words quite free of responsibility to anyone. It is no wonder that Socrates feels uneasy in their presence. In normal discourse, and especially in societies which depend principally upon the spoken word to establish and maintain community, the real origin of one's words is a serious, even critical matter. We are always forced to ask of any politician what his words mean, whether he stands behind those promises his mouth so glibly made, whether his stated intentions are really his, whether his promises weren't broken in the moment of their manufacture, as if a large crack were a part of the mold. Our presidents rarely write even their own lies, so in what sense are the lies theirs? The reader or listener must return the word to its proper habitation. The word must be sent on the same pursuit as the soul, in search of its truth, the sincerity of its source. It's long been our habit to quote the words, and hence to adopt, or temporarily to borrow, the views of others. In debate, I may attribute to historical figures convictions which they might have expressed on some famous occasion, although I was not present to hear them, as Thucydides did in his history, or Plato did when he composed the Phaedo. Again, I may cite Homer or Hesiod in order to give the weight of their authority to my otherwise airy opinions. I implicitly say by so doing that I assent not only to the sense of their sentences, but also to their style. The breath of my lungs unites us in a common course or cause. But where do these words have their home now? Where do they reside? Are they part of my soul's very flesh and blood? Have they been the words which have nourished me from the first and formed myself and established my character, been the bone of my bones, as the very diction and verbal rhythms of the King James Bible shaped the souls of the early settlers of this country, its meanings, sounds, and meters reinforced by every family reading? Suppose I could repeat every line of a poem as well as a recording. It nevertheless may be no more important a piece of my past than an anecdote might be, or a folly I recall for the amusement of my friends. As a child, I had to commit to memory. Please note the word, which suggests that memory is a lunatic asylum, and learn to recite in a way deemed impressive. The shades of night were falling fast, as through an alpine village passed a youth who bore amid snow and ice a banner with a strange device, Excelsior. And I have since then simply happened to retain in some back room of my mind Auden's immortally awful couplet, "This is the night train crossing the border, bringing the check and the postal order." But these words have never taken up residence, as we say, in my heart. nor have they fathered or nurtured other lines, sentences, further feelings, or thoughts of any significance. Our hellos and goodbyes, our concerns for one another's health, our hope that all and sundry will have a good day, these utterances, too, do not proceed from us any more than the dullest actor's lines do. They are as social as the dress suit, and are rarely homemade. It is Plato's point, of course, that almost the entire meaning of I love you depends upon what organ or area of the body is energizing the production of the words. That dull actor, indeed, may perform his greatest service simply by saying his piece and setting free its words instead of draping some interpretation like a coat over its shoulders, because it is likely that the language has more meaning than his inflection can convey, his gestures circumscribe. Then what of those passages that do follow us home, the sentiments and sentences which we adopt? What is the fate of my favorite lines of Rilke? Kannst du dir denn denken, dass ich Jahre so ein Fremder unter Fremden fahre, und nun endlich nimmst du mich nach Hause. Sunk like a ship inside me for so long, concealed now by what sort of sea growth, or preserved by the salt and thus not a day older, or worn by being repeatedly given tongue. And I murmur to myself, a stranger in a world of strangers, taking warmth and comfort from this cold conception. Then when Rilke is remembering, at the behest of Busoni, the enchanting lines of his poem, Song of the Sea, for instance, and fervently reciting them, they are words which have gone from his soul long since to return to another region of being. For surely the place they were when he wrote them is not the place they are when he remembers and recites them, nor are they the words which Busoni hears. I can also recall the expressions of others as though to confront them in court, not in their own persons, of course, but by means of their immortal residues. Yet only lovers memorize the flattery they have spoken to one another. Only spouses allow their sharp outcries of complaint to inscribe themselves upon their souls in an unerasable state. Generally, the word must be written down, set adrift from the self, before it can be returned to another starting point in the loins, the lungs, the larynx, or the lips of a stranger. And when some line of yours has set another mouth to moving, making that sense with those sounds, is that not better than a kiss? However, when a noble thought is implanted on a page, it can be harvested by rascals. What are the words of the Lord doing coming from that foul infidel's face? And when I quote some immortal lines as if I were in inner harmony with them. For instance, we do not prove the existence of the poem. It is something seen and known in lesser poems. It is the huge, high harmony that sounds a little and a little, suddenly, by means of a separate sense. It is, and it is not, and therefore is. From whence does my conceit and confidence come, since I could never have created its controlling motion? Set that sort of thought afire. Let that kind of song escape from the dirty, shaded cage I call myself. How can I ever make divine lines mine? Wittgenstein surely must have felt that the understanding which he sought with such intensity was being carried away by his auditors in little bags and sacks as though they had purchased it, that what was a process for him had become a product for others. And what could Socrates do to remind his disciples that the logos they loved was the logos of his life, and altered as he did, and grew as he hoped toward the light? That wisdom was not something which could be handed round like the mashed potatoes, but was found by means of a vocalized internal investigation, a search of the soul. For the soul would move the body wisely only if its words were wise, since it is solely through these dubious but essential diagrams of sound that the rational spirit speaks. It's the journey to the truth which convinces the traveler that he has arrived. To be dropped on the top of Mount Everest by helicopter is not to gain the glory of the peak. Often, of course, the words of others, which I have dragged squalling into my oration like someone else's children, have little substance of their own, but take their authority from the famous and often imposing figure of their father. God's word frequently walks lamely enough for the ordinary man to claim it. "Because I say so," Zeus thunders. "The orders come from me," the Führer screams. It is not the meaning and weight and arrangement, the argument, of the words themselves which persuades. The Sibyl's riddles, the oracle's ambiguities say, "Believe me because I am in touch with divinity." The highly organized harangues of the politicians say, "Believe me because I can give you what you want and tell you what you want to hear. My tongue shall lick your ear." The carefully measured considerations of the philosopher say, "Believe me because I am wise." But can the philosopher be wise before his words are? And worse, where in those words can we find the forms? Where is the deep resemblance in these syllables which will spur us to recall and spell out the unspellable ideas? The well-wrought verses of the poet, too, the periods of the orator, the sophist's sleights of speech, each says, "Believe me because I am clever, resonant, beautiful." But the beauty of any such display of talent and exercise of skill, for Plato, rests on whether its eloquence stirs others to theirs, and because the beauty of the truly beautiful depends on whether it manages to be an adequate manifestation of the ultimate good at which truth aims. Now, the great value of the Platonic myths has never been, it seems to me, the support they give to certain tenets of Plato's philosophy, or their ability to float us over difficulties like benign clouds, but the conviction they create of being true somewhere. As if the truth were a bee in a black bag. You can hear it, you know that it's there, but it certainly isn't easy to find. Furthermore, it may sting you if you succeed. "We are fallen angels," Plato tells us. "We were once winged, and now we live in the sty of our bodies, and move these bodies to and fro, restless as caged bears, aimless and confined. We must regrow those wings, harness our two horses, and climb the heavens in a path trod flat by the chariots of the gods. Turn as the soul of the world itself turns, until we can see beyond the bounds and body of the earth, with its neighboring stars and local sky, into that space which holds the unextended formulas of being. Then, drawn there by its winged steeds, its base nature in harness with the best, the soul sees the unseeable." These horses are the emblems of our organs of regeneration. The sight of beauty feeds them. Certainly the image of winged phalloi is not uncommon in Greek iconography. In the Theaetetus, seeing is described as a kind of intercourse in which emanations from the eye and object intermingle to give birth to twins. The object becomes white, for example, while the eye is filled with seeing. The imagery of the cave in the Republic is explicitly sexual, as is the nearly pornographic account of the union of the soul with the idea of beauty embodied in a boy, which we receive in the Phaedrus. The soul, to fulfill the functions which Plato's metaphors have imagined for it, must be hermaphroditic. It is phallic in its response to beauty, becoming engorged, rising, pursuing its object, and in its failures too, flaccidly falling. But it is feminine at that point when the forms fertilize the soul. What is brought to birth in Meno or in Theaetetus later are the ideas which have been laid there by their earlier intercourse with a beauty beyond the stars. The black horse, the dark unruly phallus, desires, if we may so speak, to unite with the body, to enter it, and there to realize its seedful dreams, whereas the pale phallus seeks to reproduce creatively by bringing the forms into their full fruition in the mind. In any case, the favorite sense is sight. The ear does not replace the eye at any point or passage. We do not sniff eternity or touch the forms as if they were megaliths. And if they nourish us, it is with the lover's eye that we devour them. So that when our wings wither like Icarus's close to the sun, and we fall to earth again, and when grass grows over everything we know as though it were now in a grave, the soul retains the mark, the scar, the image of what it has seen. Not in a set of sentences, not in sound sent like a message from outer space, but somehow in something like a perception. Oh, mental to be sure, not colored in, not an outline either, yet visual, the memory of the mind's eye. Now, before we suppose that Plato has simply fallen prey to a figure of speech and is here in no better shape than the poets to fight his way past appearance, we must recall two important points. First, as we moved through that famous classification of realities called the divided line in the Republic, we systematically rubbed out materiality, not in the direction of images, shadows, reflections, and illusions, which is the downward turning point of things, but in the direction of the abstracted outline of objects, arriving finally at the drawings which engross the geometer, triangles, circles, squares. That is, we took away from the visual everything we dared to, and left only those minimal qualities behind which it were yet necessary to keep the thing in sight. The taste and sound and touch and smell and inner warmth and secret kinesis of things have no representations at all in mathematics. We see the fingers we count on, the pebbles we count with, the rebus we arrange, the drawings we place upon the ground or upon the page. Second, however, and on the other side, we must remember that when we see the forms, we simply grasp systems of internal relations, and nowhere in the world of actual sight do we see those either. It is not with the eye that we speak what we have seen. And if our chief receptive action is the mind's gaze, our chief transmitting organ is the silent tongue of thought. Seeing, saying, both blind, both mute. For when in my favorite daydream I am recollecting how you looked that sunny afternoon, your body like a streak of light across the bed, what am I seeing? What is the image I have thrown upon that blackboard on the back of the lid? And when I attempt to describe the reflections of the flower stems, the way the water became green when they were thrust in the vases, what gets uttered so it can be heard outside the hall of the head? The ladder we are called upon to climb in the symposium is composed of aggressively heteronomous rungs, so that again we shall be able to see what all lovely things have in common, whether we are considering a body or a body of laws, a theorem or a theory, whether we are casting our eyes upon a noble youth or have paused, thunderstruck, on the threshold of perfect beauty. Because we shall have seen a common unity through a lens of difference, inasmuch as it is precisely the differences between philosophical systems of thought, for instance, and the poet's hymns and songs, between a pair of well-appointed breasts or youthful buttocks and the Palladian design of a pantheon, which pull the concealing flesh away to leave the bones. And the adaptation of parts to a purpose, the harmony of elements which properly proportion a whole, the idea of order as it disposes itself in the idea of order itself, none of these things, while visible, can ever be directly seen. Beauty is not present to sight, but it is always available in it. The natural world is beautiful in this sense because, as the Timaeus tells us, it is the purest, most perfect and complete, qualitative expression of quantitative law. When ideas and things separate, the word is torn in two. The Platonist derives the referent of any term, the water jug, the wagon, the motorcycle, away from its meaning, its narrow definition as well as all its additional and more elusive senses. And that wicked black horse, like materialists, realists, sophists everywhere, as Plato would suppose, wants only the sweet grass in the meadow, the lively frolic, the nuzzle, the mare in heat, and would make the word swerve to serve them, conjure them up, combine. Whereas the idealist, who rides the white horse if he does not wear the white hat, moves us into a world of meaning like a tramp into a rich flat. There is nothing for the beggar here. Here is calm connection, clean towels, fresh sheets, and wholesome sense. Consider the task of the demiurge, the shaping principle which Plato calls on to create the world in his dialogue, the Timaeus. The demiurge must mold a referent to resemble an idea. He must implement laws with instances. He must make a form which expresses a formula. A midge, a monster, a mother-in-law, inconsolable motion, which mimics its meaning, the principle of its being. But he must do so by working around the word. The word is the absent guest. It is hiding out somewhere, in the soul, as I'll suggest. And there does not at first appear on the Phaedrus' extensive list of words spoken, borrowed, recited, or remembered, or among those composed, purchased, or performed, anywhere, anyone, resembling the word of God, whose elemental utterance stilled chaos and brought light. In Genesis, we are nowhere told whether God screamed, howled, pleaded, whispered, hissed, or calmly commanded, or whether he created the word light by his act of uttering it, whether there was already a divine language for God to draw upon, although Adam appears to have made the names he confers upon the animals. In any case, in this myth at least, the word preceded the world. It is clear in this case, too, that the creative power of the word lay not in itself, but in the authority of the voice which gave it life. For you or I might have said the same thing, and deep night and chaos would have gone calmly troubling the void. Unless, and here is a thought, unless it was that any creature, you or I or the snake itself, who said the first word, would by that drawing of an imprisoned sword from its tree, its stone, like a sound drawn out of silence, have become king, creator, overlord. Now Plato's demiurge translated the eternal forms into colorful, scented, and sounding things. He spun a triangle to create a cone, and spun a cone to shape a sphere. However, the demiurge did not render reality in words. He was a sculptor, a builder, an architect, if you like, but not a poet, not a philosopher. And his task was not less than impossible if the relation between reality and the image he was to make of it was supposed to be one of resemblance. How could he model the world of becoming and base it on being that way? How could he picture permanence in change, drag an idea down into the dirt, and retain anything of its pristine features, its former splendor, its generality? The demiurge could only represent with exactitude the numbers of things, because the three members of a lover's triangle, the three bears, the three persons of the Trinity, three coins in the fountain, all embody the idea of the number three quite perfectly and precisely. Three turtle doves do not roughly approximate or simply imitate three. They are three and one more than a pair. But the doves multiply in a bird's way. They cannot be factored. They cannot be calmly subtracted from five gold rings in order to reach two French hens as a remainder. Suppose, though, that we wanted to use three items of anything to represent not three, but perhaps plurality in general. That we wanted to move from one and two to many. How soon would we see that the sign with three jugs over a table is Egyptian for flood? That is, heaven plus three water jugs. Or that three wavy lines is water, or one wave times three. Or that three wiggly lines from a cross piece is hair, or one hair in triplicate. Finally, how readily will we recognize three strokes as the general plural sign. And if we follow a Pythagorean pattern, how much more rapidly do our resemblances disappear to leave us puzzled? Four pebbles arranged, as we know, on the dice, equals a square, which equals four. The number four equals justice, the idea. In what sense, then, does justice resemble four pebbles? So as the soul passes on its journey between the rude world below and the polished forms above, it has to take a peek in both directions, as Plato suggests. Quote, "Our understanding is a recollection of those things which our souls beheld aforetime as they journeyed with their God, looking down upon the things which now we suppose to be, and gazing up to that which truly is." With the left eye, the charioteer must look where the black beast is pulling it, and see, for instance, injustice down there, like jaundice in a pale face. And then, with his right eye, he must look past the powerful shoulders of the white horse to where the idea of injustice lies like a glimmering shadow among harmony, wholeness, order, and their negation. He should not be surprised at seeing that shadow there either, because the knowledge of any evil is a necessary thing and an important good. The charioteer must match heaven's own bedstead with the bed he will shortly lie in, because only in that way can his sagging canvas cot recall to his mind the true notions of rest and recumbency which go some distance to define it. And if that is the case with the demiurge impeccable designs, that they cannot resemble the truth sufficiently to lead us alone from portrait to model, that, as fine and well-intentioned as he is, the demiurge cannot paint, say, woman well enough we would know her without a name affixed to her fig leaf, then in what worse case do we find ourselves when we describe the fair sex in words, always so inadequately, so unfairly? For in what way does woman resemble women? That is, the word woman resemble women. Even if Plato's metaphor is ultimately inexplicable, that we see both being and becoming at the same time, he knew words well enough not to choose them. Plato never suggests that we read reality in the bright light of the good. He always insists that we see it. Perhaps, as I say, I see some computations. I ask my accountant, "Let's see your results," or "Would you look over these figures?" Yet if the forms are formulas made of figures, and therefore easy to see, where is the facilitating resemblance between H2O and water, or 5,280 in a mile? How do I get, on any mimetic basis, from one to the other? But Plato has apparently provided us with three methods for gaining knowledge of the forms. The first requires that we separate the influence of the body and lower parts of the soul upon reason. For by concentrating upon the least sensuously contaminated subjects, like geometry and mathematics, we shall be able to reason clearly, free from the prejudices of perception and the biases of desire. The second suggests that we use the visual world to remind us about what we saw on our journey to the invisible one, that we match phenomenon and form as we once wall-eyed beheld them, together like ill-assorted twins. Finally, we should attempt to achieve accurate definitions of things, and this is the method which seems to require words, by careful collection and the formation of genres, along with the division of each collection by means of specific differences into enduring species. As we do so, we must arrive, we might suppose, at those combinations of words which lie nearest the signs made in the soul by the forms. These three methods are not exclusive, of course, and they could be combined or be otherwise necessary or helpful to one another. One and the same vocabulary, as far as its sounds and marks are concerned, will conceal this double reference to being and becoming. On the one hand, the word woman will refer to Franny and Helen and Olga and Ruth, whose forms merely imitate the divine. And on the other, it will designate an idea whose embrace is even more to be desired. So if I dare to add a line or two to the majestic myth which Plato has given us in the Phaedrus, I should simply say that as we rode higher and higher behind our horses in the van of the gods, and saw to one side of us, as though resting at the base of a great cliff, the upturned face of the world, perfumed, rouged, and screaming, while on the other side, in a relentless glare of clarity, which is the look of the good, appeared the timelessly tiered figures of the forms. And again, as we advanced, as it were, along this fold between meaning and things, substantial shadow and insubstantial substance, we drew a line in language from one to the other, horse, cloud, cavern, firmament, justice, desire, we sang as we rode, peace, perimeter, cabbage, cube. From that time on, our words, as if drawn by those harsher, handsome horses, sink down in the direction of things and their disconnections to pornograph among the passions, or they rise as if winged toward meanings, ideas, regions of pure relation. Is it not for this reason that the orations of the sophists, apparently employing terms like youth and love and desire and pleasure, just as Socrates would have to if he spoke on the same subject, for no one has a lien on a word, are speeches which lie as low as valleys and slowly fill with fog? They intend to speak the same lubricious lingo as their listeners, for their listeners have damp souls, damp as drains, and they long to be turned in the direction of denotation, as if the word were a wind directed at the world, and they were a vein. Throughout the dialogue, Plato has distinguished words from words, though their shells seem the same. Love in the speech of Lysias, love again in Socrates' mock argument on the same theme, love once more in his mighty oration, and so on. Words about love are quoted, improvised, read, analyzed, scorned. Socrates speaks the word sometimes as though inspired, as though he were lending his breath to another spirit. He also uses it, and his discourse about it, to reach the ultimately wordless and wholly unutterable. Love, as it rests on the bright side of the soul, signifies the upward displacement of desire toward a longing for knowledge, for a reunion with the forms. In this condition, we are like a youth or a young woman in search of our heavenly bridegroom. Such an elevated word must be spoken, for who could imagine that on the soul's journey, holding those reins, controlling those contrary horses, we have taken along a goose-necked lamp, a desk, and an inkhorn. Of course, the soul has no one to speak to but itself in the beginning. The flight of the alone, as Plotinus represents it, is of the alone to the alone. Correspondingly unpicturable is the reflection of the ideas within the silent mirror of the self. So at the center of the spirit is the unvoiced word, the living word of reason, perhaps, if you're a Platonist. But it is the rooted word in any case, the early word, the first word, the word as worm. These original words come from and have their home in the realm of forms, for they were sounded in sight of them, as though by a trumpet. Yet we must not forget that their early roots, as Plato himself rather wildly suggests, grow in both directions. Although the image of the charioteer divides our task in three, it is not an entirely accurate picture of the Platonic soul, that great conception which I have turned into a metaphor for the word and its true home. Because of its three faculties, two draw us in the direction of the world, and the one representing reason must then enlist the energies and perceptions of both the other two to do its business. In the lower depths are the instincts, the hungers, the mouth, the gut, the penetrating penis. At the middle level lie sensation, sight, smell, and so on, pleasure, pain, passion, and whatever credit the Greeks gave to the idea of the will. Neither can be called white. Nor would any of the soul's faculties recognize, in the word love alone, as a sound, any resemblance to either its idea or its condition, but only to glove and shove and other sounds equally senseless and arbitrary. Nor will Laban bring us any closer to its object. Love has no phonemes, no spelling, no pronunciation, only stages, disappointments, and degrees. Love is the transformation of a reproductive energy, and that notion, now that it has found a word like love to be its body, although its English body is a short one and without any special distinction, suppose the word for this mostly misguided exhilaration were ululation instead, or cornucopia, or Ohio. Such a word in such a body can be seduced into occupations, other occupations, stolen, put in compromising contexts, made to say the opposite of what it was meant to mean. When lust uses the language, or when our passions speak urgently and plainly, the meaning of love is first phallic and engorged, then moody and romantic. Thus there are at least three root meanings of love, and three for every word and every discourse, one for each division of the soul. At least that is one kind of cut through things, one kind of classification. Two of these loves, as I've said, look down at the world the way the dark horse does, at objects of sense, at acts of consummation. They celebrate the referent. The one remaining looks up at the bodiless copulations of the verb to be, toward the abstract, the purely inferential, the eternal. Two of these loves aim at reproducing their likeness in their partners. The first, father, sees his image reflected in his son. The second sees himself reflected in the objects his infatuation has created, while the third brings beauty to birth in beauty, in theory realizes yet another theory. One copulates, one courts and caresses, one contemplates. That's another cut. In any case, all three sources of the word are ours and reflect our specific condition, because it is upon that silent internal stage that the great debate between reason and the passions, the body and the mind, between things and their meanings, begins. Here, no one can make a speech in your place. Here, no words can have been hired for the season. The speakers refuse to give up their rights. And there are more than a few of us, I suspect, who have been repeatedly dismayed by our spirit's petty divisions, the crossness of our purposes, the shameful politics played by all the parties in the kingdom of the ego. What shall the I, who represents us, mean when it makes its noises, when it whispers, "I love you"? Will we have a clue we can regard with confidence if the object of our endearments is an enterprise, a doctrine, a Bible, a boy? No wonder Socrates is fearful that we shall freeze our meaning, end the distressing debate with a blow that breaks the argument. At one moment we believe our beloved must be good and true because we desire her so. And there are some philosophers, like Hobbes, who think that all our tunes are played in this key. At another moment, however, our desires languish behind our controlling passion like a courtly lover, our penis all poem, as we look longingly up at the pedestal where our fair one stands, as cold and polished on her stone as though carved by Canova, and as worthy of worship. In Lysias's speech, which Phaedrus recites for us, desire enlists reason to gain its ends and pushes passion aside like dirt beneath a broom. In Socrates's mocking rejoinder, passion hides itself behind desire in order to make convincing a similar case. But in the famous final oration of Socrates, and it is fully an oration, energy and feeling are joined to order and idea to produce a metaphysical climax not entirely lacking its own passionate outcry and genital spasm. Here, the mind cares, the mind comes. The word is like the soul itself, that intermediary thing which moves between the realms of being and becoming. And if my additions to the myth are not altogether unseemly, then it will be the lower parts of the logos, as well as the soul, which remember the world, and the upper one, which gazes on or connects itself to the forms. And unless these separate aspects of ourselves and our language speak in one another, respond to one another, there will be no match of thing to the form it is said to resemble. No string will stretch from significance to subject. For I argued that such resemblance could not be read from the thing itself, nor predicted from the form in its featureless silence. Lust, romantic attachment, and intellectual dedication have traveled together in that company of the gods, and that is how they come to know the nature of their rivalry. Moreover, only they can speak to one another with any chance of success, since it's indeed true that although they use the same marks, they do not use the same meanings. There are at least three languages in any language, as I've said, and only when reason leads do the words have energy, passion, and profundity in the right proportion. Only when, we might say, paraphrasing Plato, each tongue does its own job well, and the word is borne along equally, but in good order, by all of them, has the philosopher become a proper poet, one whom alone we will allow to sing of the immortal forms, as Plato has. Words which I speak to you, if you are to remember them, must be taken more deeply into the self than those which I write down, and which you can keep about your person like your tobacco, ticket stubs, or pipe. The spoken word can be questioned, because behind it there is a speaker. The spoken word is alive in a context of life. The breath, the pause, the intonation, the look of the mouth, the eye, the posture of the body, gestures of arm and tilt of head, all contribute to its meaning, confirm its ownership. The written word emasculates memory. Plato's worries on this score have proved to be correct. And the written word, which is no longer a surrogate for the real one, first voiced to the self and then to the world, is a murderer of meaning. Technical terms, jargon, diagrams, the Latin names of plants, Germanic obfuscation, none of these belong to the discourse of the soul. Furthermore, the written word comes forward as the completion of a process, not as the process itself. It quietly omits the context of composition, of discovery. It admits no doubts, no alterations, no unmeant obscurities. A field of rejected alternatives lie invisibly about the chosen word or phrase, like dead around the boy who still holds the standard. But we don't realize a battle has taken place, that blood has been shed, ideas denied, feelings changed. No, the completed sentence stretches itself out in the sun with ease and assurance. Its figure is full, even fulsome. It already has a tan. And when many completed sentences lie together to form a treatise or a novel whose composition took many years and went on in spite of illness, through love affairs, bankruptcy, and divorce, these sentences will still pretend that the same author authored all of them, that they came as they are printed simultaneously into being, that their source was as ceaselessly constant and continuous as pie. The completed text cannot be questioned and makes no reply. Yet it invites overthrow. It calls for interpretation, the way a stalled motorist might innocently call on a mugger or rapist for help. And here comes the critic, eager to replace whatever words he finds in front of him with his own. And the mind that made them with his own mind, too, concealing every evidence of creativity with his own conceit. Perhaps, grown bolder, greedier, more desperate, he will try to take the work away from its feckless writer by insisting that a text is actually a pastiche of quotation, a piece of systematic plagiarism, and the writer merely a sluice through which language streams. He will argue that the text's only home and true destination is the reader, which is a little like asserting that the true home of the bathwater is the drain, when one means only that down the drain is what will become of it. Indeed, the spoken word is addressed to someone. I can see my words touch the thought, the feelings of another. These words were made for you, shaped on this occasion for your sake, never again to be used. whereas the printed word is like a shoe which is supposed to fit every foot in society like an elastic sock. The written word repeats itself as woodenly as any signboard. It addresses itself to whomever, and even when it finds itself in a private letter, the word can be worse than overheard. It can be stolen, reproduced, counterfeited, defaced, defamed. The expression, to write something down, suggests a descent of thought into the fingers whose movements immediately falsify it. Consider what happens when the form for the triangle is displayed in a diagram. A triangle. This triangle receives an extension it didn't have before, because the form triangle is not triangular. It is not spread out in space like a piece of breakfast toast. Yet how many schoolchildren still think that these figures are triangles through and through, and calculate each hypotenuse as if they were measuring the length of a giraffe's neck. Yet further off from any element of imitation is the word itself. Similarly, the factors of a number like 8, when written out, 2 times 2 times 2 times 8 times 1, must stand in line like customers at a ticket window, and an idea, complex and total and together, finds its elements laid out like the parts list for a bicycle. Now, Plato clearly foresaw what would happen when doctrines of depth, subtlety, and importance went abroad as innocent print. I once heard a drunk in a college tavern recite a simple and beautiful poem of Blake's. It had no home in that slack, wet mouth. And the subtleties of subtle texts are immediately ignored, the complexities are erased by reviewers who regard them irascibly, and importance is equated with popularity. Of course, when I have to tell you orally what I think and mean, I cannot think perhaps as profoundly, or simultaneously mean as much. But I shall have to be clearer, if not clear. I shall never be able to say, let X, or utter an arrogant aufgehoben, or commit an act of narratology. What Plato did not foresee quite was the degree to which the written word might become as anonymous as an assassin, how it might establish a vast industry, how words would appear along roadways and on walls on the sides of buildings, not written, but posted, and addressed to whomever chanced to be passing. Words are stuck on bumpers, stenciled across chests so they can bounce with the breasts. He could not have imagined the multiplication of the written word, the printed word, the print-out word, the painted word, the filmed and photographed word, the day-glow lit-up word, the sky-written word, the repealed and stricken and canceled and censored and snipped-up cross-worded word either, and its consequent devaluation or the total trivialization of speech and conversation in addition. Roland Barthes celebrates the death of the author, another little god gone, by quoting a passage from Sarrazine to support his claim, and it bears repeating because it also proves mine. Balzac is commenting on the appearance of a castrato disguised as a woman. Quote, "This was woman herself, with her sudden fears, her irrational whims, her instinctive worries, her impetuous boldness, her fussings, and her delicious sensibility." Unquote. Barthes asserts that this sentence has no particular source or origin, no voice, and he is surely right. The castrato, of course, must exhibit these commonplaces himself, otherwise he will not appear to be the real thing, for the real, real thing in such a society is seldom seen. Certainly, a sentence of such blatantly platitudinous blather has no author behind it, unless, as Barthes seems to think, cliché can hold a bick. But he is not dismayed by this anonymity. Rather, for him, quote, "writing is the destruction of every voice, of every point of origin," unquote. Such a possibility worried Plato, whose practice in prose shows us the way to avoid it. But it did not worry many of the sophists, who encouraged the sale of words like alligator shirts. Nor does it bother many of them now, who embrace the individual and the individuated sentence only to crush its pretense to humanity, its singular style, and return it in anonymous pieces to the collectivity, itself a word almost too ugly to utter. This voice, these authors, the idea of the individual, the distinct value of consciousness are all creatures of capitalism, according to Barth, which strikes me as an odd thought, even for a falsehood, since it was the Greeks who created the soul, discovered the self, ennobled man, and sought a distinctly human good. But facts are the pets of the positivists, those descendants of the evil Enlightenment. Facts bark, but will not bite, not to worry, though facts will shed on the sofa sometimes, piss elsewhere than their pan. It seems that facts have forgone the French for the time being, gone out of style along with reason. Truth, with an enlarged initial, truth, the systematic side of the sentence, if facts are stamped on the other, truth to the ancient idealists, who are capitalists to the core, one must suppose, to them, truth was merely a god to be sought out and reverenced, and not, as it was for the sophists, an annoying inconvenience. In the small myth, in which Plato expresses his reservations about writing, the disadvantages he cites are certainly real and correct so far as they go. But writing, as I've mentioned, has freed the mind to consider far more complex matters than it ever could while operating orally. And if it has hastened the atrophy of our memory, it has saved us the trouble of holding in our head much that was not worth holding there. Although the written and the printed word greatly impersonalize, indeed standardize, our verbal tokens, they also objectify language, and hence the thoughts and feelings it contains in an important way. Because what is written is always out there, because it is public and comparatively permanent, and can be examined by many at relatively the same level of access and privilege, it is far easier to hold people to what they have said and to expect a higher standard of care to be set, because although the author is not present in the moment to produce the text, he is not dead. Print is a medium which encourages a greater scrupulosity of expression and permits more refinement of idea than the purely spoken. Of necessity, style becomes increasingly individual as the medium becomes a largely inexpressive and neutral one. It is the oral tradition which had to employ to shorten vocabulary, standardized epithets, and other mnemonic devices which encouraged its own kind of anonymity. The writer must make up for the loss of the spoken context, of the meaningful emotional environment of the uttered word, by emphasizing and bringing under control the few physical elements left. Above all, the written word must be so set down that it rises up immediately in its readers to the level of the ear and becomes a vital presence in their consciousness. It asks, that is, to be performed, to be returned to the world of orality it came from. It asks to be said, to be sung. Imagine that I was drawn to your body as a lover is drawn. Then you would see that when I touch you, I wanted to carry my love to your heart. But that means that my feelings must be allowed to flow into my fingers. And that means that you must allow my finger to move along your nerves like a voice within a wire. Then the sound of your heart will be as well the sound of my voice. And the sound of my voice, not a simple sound, not because it's mine, and not because my accent is so wondrously unique, but because it contains the touch of the true word, will circulate as one blood between us. This is what honest oratory, this is what poetry, is all about. Even if our doubts about the existence of the forms were multiple and enormous, as mine are, there is unquestionably an inner speech, a speech which represents our consciousness as it goes babbling on, and this internal talk cannot be replaced by writing. We may not be able to find our way past the last word to reach a wordless realm, as Plato desires us to do. But if we fail, we shall very likely find ourselves left with the spoken word as the only medium of real thought, although a few diagrams or mental pictures may sometimes supplement it, and machines make easy many wearisome computations. However rapidly our fingers move as we type our thoughts immediately into the sum machine, they were in unwritten form first, and will always be so. Finally, the language we learn is a spoken one. It is this speech which contains all our childhood fantasies, all our primitive and original impulses, our horror shows, our mother meanings, and whatever trips past the forms we may have taken. And it is the sound of these early words, in the total context of their production, which gives them their emotional power and connects them so closely with our basic desires. The dark horse is stabled in the child. So the poet, the rhetorician, the philosopher, who thinks of a page as merely a page and not as a field for the voice, who considers print to be simply print and does not notice the notes they form, whose style is disheveled and overcharged with energy or overrun with feeling, or whose frigid and compulsive orderings make the mouth dry, the author who is satisfied to see his words as though at a distance like sheep on a hillside, and not as concepts coasting like clouds across his consciousness, such a writer will never enter, touch, or move the soul, never fill us with the feeling that he's seen the forms, whether or not there are any, never give us that ride up the hill of heaven as Plato has, or the sense that in accepting his words, we are accepting a vision. Thank you for your patience. Now I think we break.